and welcome to Discussions with DPIC. I'm Robin Conrad, the Director of Research and Special Projects with the Death Penalty Information Center. Today, I'm excited to be joined by attorney Brian Stolarz, who is a former public defender with the Legal Aid Society in Brooklyn, New York, and who now leads the Compliance Investigations and White Collar Defense Group at the law firm LeClaire Ryan in Alexandria, Virginia. Brian was an attorney for Alfred Dwayne Brown, a man who spent a decade on Texas's death row after he was convicted in 2005 in Harris County for a murder he did not commit. With Brian's help, Brown was freed from prison in 2015 and became the 154th death row prisoner exonerated in the United States and the 13th in Texas. Brian has written a book called Grace and Justice on Death Row, The Race Against Time in Texas to Free an Innocent Man, which details the problems with a system that allowed an innocent man to be convicted and also describes the brotherly relationship that the two men developed. Although Brown has been out of prison for several years, there are still battles being fought in this case. We are grateful that Brian is here today to speak with us about the case. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you so much. Really honored to be here. DPIC has been a huge part of my work, both for Brown and just to get a sense of the death penalty in this country. So thank you for your good work, and thank you for having me.
So let's start with the basics. Will you please give our listeners a brief background about the circumstances of the crime itself that resulted in your client's wrongful conviction and death sentence?
In April 2003, there was a horrible double murder in Houston, Texas. A police officer, Officer Charles Clark, and a store clerk, Alfredia Jones, who worked at a check cashing store in South Houston. Three men committed this murder, and Dwayne Brown was convicted of murdering Officer Charles Clark. In April 2003 was the crime, and October 2005 was the trial. It was a three-day trial in Harris County before Judge Mark Kent Ellis, and he was convicted and sentenced to die.
What was the evidence that the state presented against your client in order to secure the conviction?
So there's never any science in this case, ever. No fingerprints, no CSI evidence like you see on TV, no DNA, gunshot residue, nothing. The case was solely based on witness identifications on the before and after the murders, and by cooperating testimony by one of the men who was actually there, Deshaun Glaspie, who received a 30-year sentence in exchange for his testimony, both against Dwayne and against co-defendant Elijah Joubert, who was convicted of murdering Alfredia Jones. And so the testimony really was based on witnesses who claimed that they saw Dwayne the morning of and afterwards with the other two conspirators.
So it was all eyewitness testimony.
Yes, and what I will call, the word phony comes to mind, but I, especially given recent revelations, there was scientific, and I say scientific in air quotes, evidence about cell phone use. And for me to explain that a little bit, Dwayne didn't have a cell phone in 2003, but his co-defendant, Deshaun Glaspie, did. And Deshaun Glaspie testified that he gave Dwayne his phone for the day. And then the state took Glaspie's cell phone records and then said, fine, we're going to take his records to show where Dwayne was all day because he was using Glaspie's cell phone. And they put out these fancy maps using cell phone triangulation to show where the phone was, to show the jury that that's where Dwayne was because that's where the phone was. And so really you had a combination of eyewitness testimony that turned out to be not truthful, and the product of coercion, which I'm happy to chat with you about, but also these cell phone tower maps, which we later talked to the jury. They said that that was very important to them in a non-scientific case to have some sort of science, again, science in air quotes.
Right, right. So that they would know that they could place Dwayne at the time, circumstances like the time of the crime, where he was in proximity to where this crime happened. Is that right?
Yeah, we'll take where the phone was and then take Glaspie's testimony that Dwayne used his phone during the day. It was, in our view, looking at it in hindsight, we weren't the trial counsel. It was like triple layers of hearsay because you have Glaspie saying Dwayne used his phone. And then, they took the cell phone records as to what number was called and then where he was. It's all supposition based on a cooperator trying to get 30 years instead of death penalty by saying, sure, Dwayne used my phone that day. When I got on the case, it was in state habeas still.
So let me just pause for a second. And so when I wanted to ask about your involvement in the case. And so when you say you got into the case state habeas, just give a brief description what that means for our listeners who aren't familiar with the legal proceedings.
Sorry about that.
So, that's fine.
I speak in sort of legal code, so thank you for slowing me down. So state, there's two things you could do after you're convicted. The first is what's called a direct appeal on everything that happened in the trial. Like a judge admits some evidence that you say was wrong or let some testimony in that you say shouldn't have happened. That's what's called a direct appeal, things that just occurred at the trial. But there's also what's called a habeas corpus proceeding, which you can file with new evidence, newly discovered evidence, typically DNA or affidavits from witnesses and those types of things. So you really have a wider latitude to bring to the court's attention things that they didn't already know. And so we were asked to do that part of the case, the state habeas petition.
Okay, so you got into the case during the state habeas proceedings. How did you get into the case? Were you working at a defender office in Texas, or how did you, as a lawyer, get this case out of Texas?
Sure. So I was literally sitting in a law firm two blocks down from where I'm sitting right now.
And we're in Washington, D.C., for our listeners who aren't aware.
At K&L Gates, sitting there working on white-collar criminal defense matters. We had moved to D.C. after being a public defender in New York. And I was sitting at my desk one day and got a random call from a senior partner who said, "Hey, you were a public defender one day, right?" I said, "Yeah, I love that work." He said, "Good, because you're going to work on a death penalty case." And I said, "Fantastic." And almost the next day, I flew down to go see Dwayne.
And this was your first death penalty case?
Yeah, for sure. As a public defender in New York, I probably did a couple attempted murders, but never an actual murder case. There were, I think there was a capital defenders where there was no death penalty in New York, but sort of for murder one, we didn't even do those. So like I'd never worked on a case involving these high of stakes. But at the law firm where I was probably the only one that had sort of street crime experience, as it were. So that's why I got asked to do it. We got the referral from Texas Defender Service, a wonderful organization that screens these types of cases to see what should be worked on and taken by large firms. And they reached out to our firm and asked if we had the capability to do it. And part of the good thing about working at a large law firm is they have the opportunity to put money and time and attorneys and paralegals on the case. And we took it and ran with it. And that day was one of the top five most momentous days of my life, because it turned out to be this decade-plus-long journey to help out this one man.
So let's talk about that. And how did you end up getting relief for Dwayne? So tell our listeners kind of what happened as the case unfolded, as you and your team investigated. Give us an idea of what happened to allow you guys to find this evidence that ultimately exonerated him from death row.
Well, I don't know how long you have. it was years and years of work. And so one of the first things we did was we sort of reinvestigated the case. My past as a public defender, I'm good at going to scenes and investigating and talking to witnesses. So one of the first things we did was just go to where it happened and go to where witnesses claimed they had seen Dwayne and talk to everybody that we could. And we began to realize not only were we up against the Texas death machine, which was scary enough as it is, we were up against something else, because the first witness said that they saw Dwayne in a housing complex from about 100 yards away. And so I spoke to that witness. I said, "Hey, you could see him from here," and pointing to where she said that she'd seen him. She said, "No, I didn't see him that day." And I said, "Well, why did you say that at trial that you had seen him?" And she said something that sort of rocked me and began to get me really concerned about what we were facing. She said, "Well, the DA and the cops were coming by all the time, and they said if I didn't see Dwayne sitting in that car this morning, then they take my kids away and they make my life miserable." And these are people living on the fringe of society to begin with. They don't want cops coming by and bugging them. She had a child with cerebral palsy. She was just not in the mood to be dealt with the cops like that. And so she said that she saw Dwayne that morning. And so I began to get really concerned that the witness testimony was all manufactured this way. And we began to realize that it was. Every witness we talked to gave us an affidavit that said that the truth was that they had not seen Dwayne, but they were pressured and frightened to do so. And so they did testify that way. One woman got $10,000 from a Crime Stoppers fund. If you see something, say something, you get $10,000. And she said that she saw Dwayne, got the 10. Then she wanted to recant and say, no, I really didn't see him. Then they were going to charge her with perjury and theft of the $10,000. So like there was a lot going on, and we were unpacking it day by day, week by week, when we were down there. But I tell you what, the most critical witness was Dwayne's girlfriend, Erica Dockery.
Tell our listeners about that. I think that that is a really interesting part of the story.
Yeah, that is the most critical part, because in a non-scientific case, which is what they had no way to tie him there scientifically. They needed witnesses. And the witnesses that recanted were ones that saw him allegedly the morning of and afternoon of, and they were just totally unreliable. They needed something to really get him there.
Like put him there at the time of the crime.
That's right, yeah, because he's saying, and those witnesses just said morning and afternoon, we were able to show that he was not there. So they really wanted to focus on where he was during the morning of the crime.
What was the location of the crime, the store?
Yeah, so it was in a sort of nondescript strip mall in South Houston with about four or five stores, check cashing place, which is where the crime occurred, like a low-rent furniture store and like a cell phone store, just sort of a nondescript kind of little strip mall in South Houston. And so Erica Dockery, and I just want to say, Dwayne is, and I'll get to this later when we talk about the book, is probably the most sort of, he's like a brother to me, and I love the man. And if he were sitting here with you, he would tell you what he told me the first day, which is he was nowhere near this crime, didn't commit this murder. He was at Erica Dockery's apartment. And that morning, made a phone call to where she worked. And that is his alibi, full stop. He's got an IQ of 69, so he's very linear, very like, this is what happened. I wasn't there. Here's where I was. And so Erica was a very critical witness.
And Erica was his girlfriend at the time?
At the time, yep. So, yeah, and then she goes to the grand jury. And I guess for the listeners who don't know what a grand jury is, I guess I would explain that too. So a grand jury is nothing like you see on TV where there's a public and there's a judge and everything. It's a room, really like a classroom, where a prosecutor presents evidence to grand jurors, usually members of the public, who then decide if there's enough to go forward with a crime. And so if there is, then the person gets charged and then you have the trial like you see on TV. And so Erica goes to that body, to that grand jury, and says, yeah, when I left for work that morning, he was home at my apartment. And later that morning, I received a phone call and I looked down on my caller ID box, which when I give this speech to colleges and law schools, I got to explain what a caller ID box is. But you probably had one growing up, or maybe your grandparents did.
No, we had caller IDs. And for the younger listeners, it was just like how a number pops up on your cell phone, but it was a detached box that was sat next to your rotary phone.
That's right. And that's what Erica testified to. She looked down on this box. She was working as a home health aide for an elderly woman, looked down. And the elderly woman said, Erica, it's your house. Phone got picked up, and as Dwayne, they had a conversation. One of the most straightforward alibis I've ever heard, actually. And she testified that way and said, yeah, that's what happened. And the DA, who was frustrated with the lack of hard evidence in this case, pressured her in the grand jury. And also, the grand jurors themselves pressured her. There's excerpts in the book about what the grand jurors were threatening her with. They said, if you're lying, we're going to take your kids away, make your life miserable. We're going to do things bad to you. Tell the truth. Please tell the truth. Don't protect this man. They were very, very aggressive.
So these are the grand jurors who are asking questions to Erica.
Right. And there's a whole nother part about the grand jury that I'm going to get to, because the grand jury played a really pivotal role in this case. But the prosecutor's name is Dan Rizzo, was asking her questions, and the grand jurors were pelting her with questions too. She was badgered. She was threatened, but she held up. At the end of the grand jury session, she's like, no, he was there. Like, the truth is the truth. He was there. And then she got put into an ante room. And according to an affidavit that she gave me, her words, not mine, the DA comes over to her and says, if you don't tell me what I want, I'm going to make you a co-defendant like your boyfriend and give you the needle. And really pressured her and frightened her. And he decided to charge her with perjury. Now, this is the moment the whole case turns. He decides on his own volition to charge her with perjury, saying that she lied in front of the grand jury.
What was that based on?
His belief that she was lying, really. The evidence he didn't have. He had other witnesses who maybe said they saw Dwayne there. So he believed the other witnesses instead of her, decided to charge her with perjury. And he could do that under what's called a prosecutor's information, a charge, because he could arrest her and then impanel a grand jury to indict her. So he had the leverage to arrest her and charge her, and he did. And that's the moment when the whole case changes, because she tells the truth. She goes in there and tells the truth about where he was. She gets pressured by the grand jurors, pressured by the DA, charged with a felony by the DA The DA asked for a very high bail, which is uncommon in a perjury case.
Let me just ask you, was she allowed to go home after she testified at the grand jury and then she was later charged, or did this all happen on the same day?
No, it was subsequent, but not too far afterwards. She went home but then was picked up. I'm not sure the exact timing, but shortly. And a high bail was sought, which in my public defender days, I've done hundreds of arraignments. We used to do night court, like you see on that old sitcom. And I did 100 a night, not 100 a night, 100 a week. And for a case like this, she would never have had a high bail set on her. She had no real record. She would have been set free. But he knew that if he asked for a high bail and he got it, she'd be sitting in there. And she sat. It was charged. Couldn't make the bail. She lost her job. The CPS was coming around. Like, the things that he wanted to have the leverage over her was happening.
Child Protected Services.
Yeah. They were coming, yeah, for her children. And ultimately, after about 7 weeks, she's like, fine. I'll say whatever you want. I got to get out of this hellhole. I just got to get out of here. She would later tell me that she chose her kids over Dwayne. And that was sort of a pivotal moment. So then she decided to abandon the truth and tell the jury that he wasn't home when she left work that morning. And that, yes, a phone call came from him, but he was calling from the housing complex where the other two guys were. And that, Robin, is the evidence. A witness who said they saw him in the morning. A witness said they saw him later. Deshaun Glaspie in his cooperating testimony, who he got 30 years in exchange. These cell phone tower maps, which were just manufactured and not real. And Erica's testimony. And that's it. That is the testimony over the course of 3 days. That's the other thing I want your folks to know on the line here. 3 days for this trial. I mean, I have a trial coming up that's going to take 6 weeks. And the person's not going to, you know, if found convicted, will not go to jail for a long period of time. 3 days, like guilt was sort of like foretold from the beginning. I don't say this everywhere, but he got an offer of 40 years for this. And 40 years on a police officer shooting case is a pretty reasonable and generous offer in Texas. He'd have been out in 20, but he refused to sign for it because he did not do the crime. And, you know, there's so much to this case, and I hope I'm able to just show you that what I found is that the whole system bore down on this one man. A good, innocent, decent man. And I was never really sure that I was going to be able to get him the relief that I so desperately wanted to get him because of the way Texas prosecutes the defendants, especially capital defendants. I actually thought I'd watched my friend die. And that got me incredibly depressed, incredibly emotional. And as I sit back and look at it now, many years later, I can't believe it all happened.
Well, let me ask you this. So the police coerce Erica into lying on the stand. She testifies. She says that Dwayne wasn't at her house, even though she knew that he was. So how did you end up being able to find that information out? I mean, were you able to, did you knock on the door and she tell you the truth and say, oh, I lied? I'm guessing because she was probably worried about repercussions if she then came forward with the truth later on. So tell our listeners how you and your team were able to find out that she was lying or maybe prove that she was lying.
Sure. So this is something you'd see in a John Grisham thriller, really. When I retell the story across the country, I still can't believe that I'm going to say what I'm about to say. So Dwayne's story and alibi was he was at Erica's apartment, made a phone call to where she worked. And so I was focused on this phone call, right? I was focused on if I could prove the phone call existed, like Erica said it did, then I could prove where he was, and then he wasn't at the scene. It fairly, you know, that was my mission.
Because the time frame was a fairly short time frame. They knew when this crime actually occurred. So if you could prove that call came in from that house, that would be able to basically prove his alibi?
Exactly. It's a landline phone. So he was at that residence. And, you know, the testimony at trial was that he was with these co-conspirators before and after. So he could never have been at home at the time that the phone call came in. And so the phone call was absolutely critical. It was something that I thought about all the time. And we subpoenaed the phone company, and they said, nope, that was many, many years ago. We don't have the records anymore. We subpoenaed the DAs, no. Subpoenaed the cops, no. And I'd go back and see him, and I'd be incredibly frustrated and depressed. And I'd cry. I was like, I cannot find these phone records. I'm so sorry. And, because of who he is and the grace that he showed to me, he would calm me down. The guy who was in, a cell that he could touch arm to arm and flat-footed touch the ceiling, he brought me peace that I didn't have. And it was just amazing relationship that he and I ended up having together. And every time I'd leave, I feel more inspired to go find the truth. And so we had a hearing coming up to bring forward all the witnesses who had recanted. The witnesses, the morning of, we got Erica to finally come forward and talk to us. She initially wouldn't. Every time I'd get a tip on where she lived, I'd fly down there. And she'd slam the door in my face, wouldn't talk to me. Because she got involved in the system once, didn't want to do it again. But in sort of a moment of really just amazing beauty in this case, Anthony Graves, who was the exoneree before Dwayne in Texas, Dwayne's exoneree 13 in Texas, Anthony Graves is 12. Anthony Graves called me after he got out and said, "Hey, your boy Brown doesn't belong there. Can I help?" I was like, "Well, yeah, absolutely." And so he went and visited with her and said, "Hey, my girlfriend was also pressured back in the day. Will you please just talk to Dwayne's lawyers?" And that, I think, was the tipping point for her. And she did talk to us and gave us an affidavit saying that the truth is the truth. What I went to the grand jury and said is the truth. And so I had that. And I had the other witnesses who had recanted. And we were going to have a hearing about that. And about 2 weeks before that hearing, which we're going to bring everybody together, testify about the recantations, we get an email from a writ DA, the DA who's in charge of this case, and on the appellate side, on the writ side. And it said that the homicide detective in charge of the case had recently been spring cleaning his garage. And I say those words, that's her words, spring cleaning his garage, and found a box of documents on the Brown case. And we saw that, we're like, okay, we didn't know what to expect. The documents from the garage get sent from the garage to the DA's office, to our local counsel office in Dallas, and one of my colleagues gets it. And inside that box, in the middle of the box, was the phone record that we've been looking for years.
Wow.
I still can't believe I tell the story. From a garage to freedom is what this is. Because the phone record showed, it's in the book, there's a picture of it. There it is, landline phone record with the police officer's handwriting on it saying Dobie's Dwayne's nickname. Dobie's girlfriend landline in the South Loop, and the phone call from the home, Erica Dockery's home, to the woman, Alma Berry, where she was giving the home health aid work. And I was elated because finally it showed that he was where he said he was the whole time.
Right, and you had tangible proof. Now, why was this box at the home of the detective? Had he been retired or?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I look forward to finding the answer about that one day. It's funny, when that happened, my 10-year-old at the time said, "Daddy, why were there documents in a police officer's garage?" And her question is exactly the question I want to know. And I don't know the answer to that. He was retired. He is retired now.
If something would have happened and that box never had been discovered or he hadn't been spring cleaning, what could have happened to your client?
I know. That's and when I give this speech across country and I try to explain to people why I believe the death penalty is wrong, I say, think of how capricious this is. A box in a garage just says Brown on it. Could there have been a fire, a flood? Could they have moved and just pitched it? Could they have got rid of the documents? And we don't know whether we'd ever find that phone record, but we did. And so despite the fact that it worked on the case, I've been on the case now for 11 years. I say now I'm really not that good of a lawyer. I'm just lucky that we happened to get this box. But what I didn't tell you was what was attached to the phone record, which is remarkable, was a subpoena from the DA's office to the phone company that is dated the day after Erica testified in the grand jury about that same call. So the chronology is this. Erica testifies in the grand jury. Yes, he made a call from my home to where I was working at the day. The next day, the DA signs a subpoena to the phone company to get those records. The records come back showing Erica was telling the truth. But that document was never turned over to Dwayne's defense lawyers at trial. And we only got it through spring cleaning of a garage. When you say that, you realize how broken the system was and how broken it was for Dwayne and how, but for the work of many, many lawyers, not just me, I get to tell the story because he and I became brothers, really. That's why I tell the story. But we had so many lawyers and people working on this case, from K&L Gates and from just TDS helping us. I don't know. I get pretty emotional every time I tell the story because I still can't believe that a document from a garage saved a man's life.
So let's talk about the prosecutor and what the prosecutor actually knew, because it sounds like from what you said, the Dwayne's girlfriend testified to the truth at the grand jury, and the very next day the prosecutor subpoenaed the phone records, which showed she in fact was telling the truth, but went ahead and prosecuted Dwayne and also threatened to charge her with perjury. So why don't we talk for a few minutes about how that happened and what has recently come to light about the prosecutor in this case.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk about this. This is the first podcast I've done since the revelation, so I'm excited to talk about it. And so, as I mentioned, Erica testified in the grand jury about the phone call, and Dan Rizzo sent the subpoena. There was always a question as to whether Dan Rizzo actually saw the phone records that came back, because the subpoena was returnable, and that just means send back to the cop. The subpoena is to the phone company to say, dear phone company, send these records to the HPD. And so...
so there could have been the possibility that the cops received the records and never showed it to the prosecutor, right?
Well, that was a supposition that had been floated by some. And when Dwayne was released, it was floated by the prosecutor himself, saying that he had not seen these records. And even to go so far as he told Lisa Falkenberg, who is an amazing journalist who won their paper's first Pulitzer based on the coverage of this case.
And I do want to ask you a little bit about the journalist's involvement in Dwayne's case, but we'll talk about that in a few minutes.
Yeah, absolutely. We have to, because okay. They were critical, and I'm grateful to them. He told her that he had never seen them, and that if he had seen them, he would have turned them over, sort of in a, well, if I saw them, I would have turned them over, in sort of a, defender of justice kind of way, right?
And to interject again, by turning them over, the prosecutor has an obligation, if there's exculpatory evidence that he or she finds, to turn that over to the defense. So it's part of this sense of fairness and justice and seeking truth. So that's what he was saying, that if he knew that those records existed, he would have turned them over.
You know, he said all those things when Dwayne was released. And, you know, we didn't have proof that Dan Rizzo actually saw the phone records. Until a couple weeks ago, we have, in the process of a civil lawsuit, which we could talk about later, we issued discovery requests to the county and to the city, and we got an email that I brought with me. And the DA, Kim Ogg, the Harris County District Attorney, and issued a press release saying that... it now appears, based on this newly discovered document, that Dan Rizzo was aware of the phone records in April of 2003.
So before the trial happened, he knew that these phone records existed and that Erica Dockery was telling the truth during the grand jury testimony.
Right. April 22nd, 2003, at 4:21 to be exact, 3 weeks after the murder. And years, literally 2.5 years before the trial, before Dwayne's trial. There's an email from Breck McDaniel, which is the police officer who found the documents in his garage, to Dan Rizzo, with the subject reading, court order on Dobie's, Dwayne's, girlfriend's apartment's home phone. And there's a press release on it if you want to go find it. You should read this. Breck McDaniel writes to Mr. Rizzo and says, hey, there's a new development here. And he writes, I was hoping, this is the cop, I was hoping that it, meaning the phone records, would clearly refute Erica's claim that she received a call at work from Dobie at 10 or so from her apartment, thereby putting him at the apartment as an alibi, as his nephew's claim, as her nephew's claim, which is Erica's nephew's, also validated the fact that he was at her apartment. But it looks like the call detail records from the apartment shows that the home phone dialed Erica's place of employment at around 8:30 and again at 10:08. This is a new development. That's what he says. The DA's office issued a press release.
This is the current press release.
Yeah, the current press release on March 2nd, 2018, before it was even produced to us in discovery, because they knew how groundbreaking it was. And it said, a previously undisclosed email between former Harris County prosecutor Dan Rizzo and former Houston Police Department officer Breck McDaniel is being released Friday to lawyers representing Alfred Dwayne Brown in a civil rights lawsuit against Harris County. The email is new evidence in the civil case brought by Brown. She writes, the new evidence suggests, however, that well before Brown's trial, Rizzo was informed about the existence of the records, yet failed to disclose or provide them to the defense counsel or the jury. Without access to actual records, the defense was unable to use them in Brown's defense. And the district attorney's office stated that they will notify the State Bar of Texas of this newly discovered evidence so it can investigate Dan Rizzo's professional conduct while handling the Brown case. And so this was a blockbuster development. And, you know, what Breck McDaniel says, I think it's a new development. Well, it certainly was a new development in April of 2003. It is definitely a very new development in March of 2018. So if you think about that, Dwayne is arrested in April of 2003. And we don't know the full truth about who knew what until March 2nd of 2018. And I give credit to the whole legal team who stuck with this case for this exact moment of, I believe, vindication. We are pending a lawsuit in the federal court in Texas, so I can't really speak more about it.
Can you tell our listeners what this lawsuit is that's pending in federal court? Can you at least talk about the subject matter?
So to back it up a little bit, Dwayne was, because of the phone records, Dwayne was granted a new trial by the Court of Criminal Appeals, and the DA's office declined to prosecute him, dismissed the case against him, and on June 8th of 2015, he walked out.
Right. I guess we never got to the point of him actually getting relief. So
yeah,
glad you clarified that for our listeners. He was released from prison.
He's released June 8th of 2015. And we sought compensation from the state because the state actually, for all of its faults, is a pretty generous statute of $80,000 a year for every year you're in, plus that same amount in an annuity.
And that's for people who can show that they were innocent. If they were wrongfully convicted, what is the criteria?
Yeah, so that's the statute is written in such a way that it requires a finding of actual innocence either by the habeas court, or the Court of Criminal Appeals in this case, or an affidavit of actual innocence filed by the district attorney's office. And so we didn't have that in this case.
Right, because he was granted a new trial, but then the district attorney just decided not to re-prosecute.
That's right. Yeah.
So, And then the district attorney did not agree to sign an affidavit of actual innocence.
Right, and that's the stumbling block we had on the petition for compensation directly to the state. Although now it's obviously very clear what happened here. The district attorney who dismissed the case was Devin Anderson, a different DA than Kim Ogg. Kim actually has another 2 months under the statute to declare him actually innocent, and I hope she does. But because we're not able to get him state compensation, we filed a lawsuit in federal court in Houston alleging violations of Dwayne's civil rights, essentially that they prosecuted him maliciously through the getting witnesses to testify to the falsely, to the Brady evidence not being turned over, and a very long 75-page complaint in federal court in Houston, which we've sued the city, which is the cops, sued Dan Rizzo, sued Kim Ogg, but as the current district attorney and as the representative of that office, and the individual police officers. And Dan Rizzo was actually dismissed from the case because prosecutors get absolute immunity, which we could do a whole nother podcast on.
Can you give a 30-second explanation of what absolute immunity means?
Yeah, it sort of means what it sounds like. Prosecutors are generally immune, which means not liable for civil conduct. Police officers are given what's called qualified immunity, which is a whole nother, you'd have to take a law school course on these things, but qualified immunity sounds like what it sounds like. You get immunity, but it's qualified by finding out the facts and whether it's within the scope of their duties and those types of things and whether it wasn't really egregious conduct or not. But that's an oversimplification and probably not the right one. But anyway, but Rizzo was kicked out of the case, dismissed from the case. But we have leave to amend, and we're considering all options on whether to include him based on this newly discovered evidence that we have.
This new evidence really shows that he knew and he went ahead with a prosecution, even though he had evidence showing that Dwayne wasn't actually there at the time of the crime.
Yes, that's what it does. That's what we believe, and we are... I don't know the words, actually. I'm saddened by it in a lot of ways. That, you know, the culture of conviction in Harris County at the time could lend to such a result.
What do you think caused this to happen? I mean, having this orchestrated manipulation, manufacturing evidence, forcing witnesses to change their truthful statements. I mean, based on bullying, based on threats of prosecution, threats of taking away children. I mean, what have you discovered based on working on this case, something that either gave rise to that type of culture and or what types of things could be in place to prevent that type of culture from, you know, happening?
Yeah, so that's a deep and thoughtful question and one that I've given a ton of thought to. And I write about it in the book quite a bit because, I don't know, I had this vision when I went to law school and when I was a public defender that everybody's going to play fair, right? There's sort of a, you know, justice is usually served if the parties, you know, abide by their roles and what they're supposed to do. In this case, that didn't happen. And so you wonder why. And so, you know, we've alleged in the complaint and also talk about it in the book, this like culture of conviction, like I say. And what you have is you have a decorated, by all accounts, a very good person in Officer Charles Clark who died. And you have an indigent black man accused of murdering him who's got an IQ of 69, can't afford a lawyer, and you're in Houston, Texas. And so the whole system bore down on Dwayne for this sort of, I don't know, Western-style justice where Dan Rizzo was out to get justice, and I say justice in air quotes, justice for Officer Clark's family, for which I say prayers for all the time because, of course, no one wants this kind of violence to happen with anybody, police officers or anyone. But the real shooter of Officer Clark is still out there. And so I say, why? And he had a lawyer who didn't either believe in him the way we did. But also I have to give some sort of leeway to her because she was fighting with one arm tied behind her back because she didn't have the phone records. She was fighting against an opponent who was not playing fair. And so it's everything that's wrong with the system in one case.
Was this a high-profile case, perhaps a case where we see a rush to judgment to get somebody and they had decided that they thought Dwayne was the person who committed this horrible crime and with the political pressure, especially when a police officer is killed. I mean, did you notice that theme in this case as well? Because we see that often in these high-profile police officer killings and this pressure on the district attorney's office and pressure from the community to go ahead and make an arrest and get a conviction without potentially sidestepping the necessary protections that are in place to ensure we don't have an innocent person convicted.
The answer is yes. It's a high-profile case. White police officer, indigent black man charged with murdering him. You can't, I mean, I don't like to delve too deep into the race on this because it makes me kind of sick to think that, you know, but for me and Casey Kaplan, Bethany Benitez, Chris Tate, a whole bunch of like justice warriors bent on one man's life, they would have gotten away with it. And Dwayne would be in the ground.
Or if the police officer wasn't spring cleaning.
Right. Well, that.
I mean.
That shows just how crazy and capricious this whole thing is. But if you think about it, from the jump in April 2003 and the new evidence that on April 22nd, 2003, the cop emails Dan Rizzo and says, hey, we got a new development here. Erica looks like she's telling the truth. If we didn't devote all this time and love, frankly, there's no other word for it, but love for this one man, he'd be dead. And that makes me, there's not even an emotion I could put on that. When I'm with him and we talk and I say, I cannot believe that he's free. But what he tells me, and he's a man of very few words, he says, there's more of me out there. And so part of why I tell the story, and part of why I'm talking to you right now, is to find the other ones. And it breaks my heart when he says that, because I know if Dan Rizzo did this in this case, I don't know what he did in other cases. But this is a call to action because this case feels like fiction, but it's not.
But what would you suggest that could happen in either the DA's office and police departments, in other systems, in the court system that you've seen, that you've thought about to help prevent innocent people from being convicted and, in this situation, sentenced to death?
So I think the first line of defense is the defense. And I think my number one suggestion is a well-funded, well-trained capital defense force, who that's all they do. In Houston at the time, it was just private lawyers who could take on a case. They had to be qualified to handle the kind of case, but you know, if you're doing 15 or 20 other felonies and you don't have the time to devote to this and you don't have a full-time investigator, those types of things. A well-trained capital defense force is my number one recommendation. And I think if you fund and support capital defenders, that's line one of defense, because no one's ever going to care for the client as much as the defense lawyer. And if the defense lawyer doesn't care or doesn't do the job well, then that's, you know, the person's in trouble. But then you got to think about, well, how do we get the prosecutors and the police to play fair? I worry that in high-profile cases, this same thing will happen again. I do. And that's why I tell the story. We need open file discovery. Some states have fought against that. But even if you have open file discovery, it doesn't mean that everything's going to be in it. And so what else can you do? Well, I say in the book that, you know, I'm not, you know, my wife is a former prosecutor, and I know she played fair. And so I don't advocate for, you know, putting prosecutors in jail all the time. That's not what I'm out there saying. But if someone intentionally withheld records, you know, sort of in an obstruction of justice type scenario, where they intentionally withhold something, then maybe there should be investigated, whether by the state bar or for criminal prosecution.
And there are some states that have taken away somebody's bar license, a prosecutor's bar license, if they have done things such as what happened in this case.
And I think there has to be more of that to show prosecutors that, hey, there might be something on the other end if you don't play fair. And I think that's, you know, it's not about winning. And I think part of this culture of conviction in Harris County and other places is about winning. And that kind of bothers me.
So let me ask you, I know we've taken up a lot of your time, but briefly about the role that the journalists played in this case. You had mentioned Lisa Falkenberg and that the Houston Chronicle won a Pulitzer for her, reporting that she did in this case. So how did that come into play? Did you work with the journalists? Did they do digging on the case on their own? What was going on and how did that unfold? And how do you think that the media plays a role in outcomes in the courts?
Yeah. So this is a challenging one because some lawyers will tell you, don't ever talk to the media, ever. And I don't subscribe to that. But we weren't seeking media attention. We were working really hard on the case. But then after a lot of inaction, we made some calls and got some interest by Lisa Falkenberg, who, I tell you what, she is amazing. And she earned her Pulitzer times 10, and she worked really hard to uncover the truth here. And to her credit, you know, when I would tell her what I thought was the truth, and she said, well, I'm going to come to my own conclusion and I'm going to investigate and figure it out. She didn't just buy the fact that I was telling her that Dwayne was innocent. And her web series called Dead Man Waiting is extraordinary because she found some stuff that I didn't know. And she was able to begin to change the narrative about people, how they thought about Dwayne Brown. And the inaction by the state is actually what spurred it on, because this gets a little wonky, but I'll explain it. The trial court granted him a new trial, but it had to be approved by the Court of Criminal Appeals. So this is just how it worked in the procedures of Texas. And we waited 17 months for that. So the trial court was like, yeah, let's have a new trial. But the appellate court was waiting for later. We found it to be political reasons. Some judges were up for election, all that. But in those 17 months, Lisa did a amazing job in taking a look at the facts, taking a look at the transcripts, talking to witnesses. But she really honed in on the grand jury process and Lisa and Erica Dockery. And what she found was astonishing, that one of the people that was badgering Erica in the grand jury, threatening her enough, was a sitting police officer. It was an active duty police officer. So you have an active duty police officer sitting on a police officer shooting case grand jury. It was astonishing to me. And then she found out, and Texas had what's called the pick-a-pal grand jury system, in which we can do a whole other hour on that, but I'll explain it really quickly. Texas had a judge. The judge in charge of the case would impanel a commissioner, usually a friend, and they would bring all their buddies to the grand jury. Like, if we decided instead of talking today, we'd just go to the grand jury. And this one woman sat on 12 grand jurors. She was like a professional grand juror. And she was a donor to the DA's office, donor to the cops. And it was not a grand jury of your peers. It was a grand jury of, you know, donors and friends and, like, you know, people who were supporting law enforcement. So what were you going to get? You're going to get rubber stamp grand jurors. And so Lisa honed in on that. A lot of articles about that. And Texas changed how they do their grand jury system as a result of this case.
Wow.
And so now grand jurors are impaneled just like every other state, which is a letter, the annoying letter you get in the mail and you show up. So now grand jurors are composed of the society. And that, to me, is one of the big major changes in this case. Because defense lawyers have reached out to me and said, yeah, it's great you got him out, but now the grand jury is more composed of our diverse community, because Houston's one of the most diverse cities in the country. And so the DA does not have a stacked deck in the grand jury. They don't take marginal cases anymore, because they know that they're going to have a grand jury is going to push back as opposed to threatening witnesses.
Well, I want to end on hopefully a positive note and just tell the listeners a little bit about the book that you wrote. And, you know, we've talked about it. You've mentioned it throughout this podcast. But I guess I'm curious as to what made you decide that you wanted to write the book and tell Dwayne's story. And what would you want to share with our listeners about the book?
I knew the moment I met Dwayne that he was innocent. So I was able to figure out who was sitting across from me in a jail cell pretty quickly. And I just felt something real deep the first time I met him. And I took really good notes from the moment I met him, because I knew this was the case of his life and the case of mine. And so what started off being sort of a legal journey turned out to be sort of a personal mission and a religious mission. I felt it was my duty in life to work on this one case. And so I wanted to tell the story, just to sort of ask people, what would you do for one person, right? What would you answer a call to arms? Would you answer a call for justice? And so I wrote it as like a personal spiritual journey. And, you know, people say that we saved his life. I don't really see it that way. I think he kind of saved mine. And it's my honor to talk about it and my honor to write about it. And I want people to read it and feel inspired to go find their own Dwayne, find their own cases, whether it's a death penalty case or something else you feel passionate about. And I don't know, I kind of want to retire.
Not yet.
Not yet.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Brian, for being here and speaking with us about Dwayne's case. And we will look forward to see how things unfold. And I just want to let our listeners know, if you want to learn more about Dwayne's case, you can purchase Brian's book, Grace and Justice on Death Row, online from websites such as Amazon or Barnes & Noble, or you can find it at your local bookstore. To learn more about the death penalty, visit our website at www.deathpenaltyinfo.org and subscribe to the podcast on your podcast app of choice.